I would like to welcome our second guest, who's now our first guest, Alex Richards, who is the author of the new novel, Back Talk, and she will be today at Garcia Street Books, signing books and talking about her new book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks a lot.
It's great to have you. Now, this book is about a high school girl named Gemma who gets an internship in New York City with a daytime TV talk show. Some or much of this is from your own experience, is it not?
That's right. Well, the time frame isn't exactly correct, but I worked in a talk show after I graduated from college. I worked there for 2 years. It was the John Walsh Show, who's the guy that hosts America's Most Wanted. So it was sort of Oprah-esque in, you know, our style of shows that we did. But yeah, I just learned so much from my 2 years there about the whole inside scoop of TV, and then I decided that it would make a really good book.
And why did you get out of that type of work?
Well, the specific show got canceled after 2 years. Our ratings just weren't up to snuff. And I tried finding work still in that industry, and I don't know, my heart wasn't in it. I wasn't really finding anything. It's really competitive, and what I've always really loved to do is write. So I just sort of started writing a book about it. I thought, you know, what better thing to do? And it just sort of really flowed out of me, and I finished it in just a few months.
Isn't that interesting? One of the things that I was struck by, the girl is 16. Is it usual to have a 16-year-old intern on the show?
No, a lot of our youngest interns were probably like freshmen in college, so it was a little bit tweaked, but there are definitely tons of internships, you know, in the city. They, especially in the summer, you know, when high school kids have breaks and stuff, it looks so good on your college applications.
One of the amazing things was the unrelenting judgment on the part of this girl and her friends, positive or negative judgment, of everybody they come in contact with on the basis of usually the most superficial things.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's I feel like that's definitely true everywhere, but I would say especially in New York and especially in the television industry, where it can be an incredibly superficial industry, and you really base things on looks and, you know, whatever first judgmental opinions that you have.
But they also bring that to all their other relationships. In other words, you know, somebody's hair, somebody's shoes, the you know, cuteness level on a scale of whatever, this boy or that boy. It's almost exhausting to read it, and it reminds one of how insecurity gets played out at that age.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. High school is, and you're under a magnifying glass constantly, and, you know, as much as you give out, you know, looking at people and judging them, they're kind of giving it right back to you. So it's like you're constantly kind of walking on eggshells, I feel like, at that age, sort of being concerned with what everybody thinks about you. Yeah, and they're incredibly judgmental, but I would say it's pretty accurate.
It sounds it. I mean, you have a great ear for language. One of the other things is the slang that they speak, the English that they speak, which I, as the reader, felt would be pretty much undiscernible to any fluent speaker of English from any other country.
Yeah.
Even New Mexico.
That's true. That's definitely true. There's just certain slang that I feel like teens pick up and they create their own words. And then it's somehow manages to make the circuit, and suddenly everybody knows what it is. But yeah, it's
everybody under a certain age.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And it's interesting because there's sort of a, I guess you would say, it creates a wall between people of that age who are speaking that way and every, you know, the other generations.
Yeah, definitely. There's something that makes teenagers who they are. It's hard to kind of crack the code, and I think that's what makes it. They have their own little world. I mean, these characters especially, you know, there aren't a lot of, like, adult figures in the book, and one of the only adult characters that there is sort of the housekeeper, and she's Mexican in the first place, so she really just doesn't know what they're talking about. It just makes it that they don't have to have too many private conversations because they can kind of just understand what they're doing.
And the housekeeper is sort of a wisdom figure.
Yeah, yeah. She's definitely who Gemma goes to for advice, since she's a small town girl from Idaho moving to New York for the first time ever, so this city and this new life is completely overwhelming, and she's totally freaked out by it, so she goes to this older housekeeper for a little wisdom and comfort when she feels sort of alone. And her friends are very cool and very fun to be with, but they're it takes a while for her to really feel comfortable and, you know, able to open up to them.
And there's also a pretty large gap of wealth and class between the girl from Idaho and her wealthy roommates.
Absolutely, which I feel like is really constant everywhere. I think everybody has that really, you know, a really rich friend, and then most of us are kind of like, well, I'll go to Old Navy and see, you know, if I can just kind of scrape my dimes together and find something. And so it's hard for her to keep up in their world of Jimmy Choo's and total fashionista lifestyle.
We're talking to Alex Richards, and the book is called Back Talk, and she will be tonight at Garcia Street Books at 5 in the afternoon. One of the themes is sexual harassment of various kinds. There's one scene in which a coworker tries to rape our heroine, and she actually has to be convinced that it wasn't her fault.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sad how really common that is, but, you know, it's a guy that she really likes, and it's sort of a pseudo date that they're on, and he really pushes too far, and it's hard, I think, in hindsight to think, oh, like, maybe I was egging him on or something. I think it's such a common situation that so many people have been through, and it's sort of, I don't know, I thought it was important to kind of help her work through it with her friends and realize just how many sides there are to a story like that, and that it really is never your fault, and it's just, you know, it's another part of her being small town girl coming somewhere and just being really naive and just not really knowing how to handle a really extreme situation like that.
And yet she's got a lot of savvy and she's got a lot of guts. I mean, she comes out of it and say something along the lines of, wow, he dumped me before we even had a date because I wouldn't let him rape me.
Yeah, I mean, she's hard on herself. She's judgmental. She's completely neurotic. But I think all those things sort of make her lovable and also make her an easy target for this guy. But not apparently as easy as he thought, because I think every girl has sort of like an inner strength that they, you know, you're able to pull through in an extreme moment that she really found she was able to. Throughout the book, she kind of grows, and it's like she just becomes stronger and stronger, sort of with every scene and every experience. There's always somebody trying to bring her down, which I think is fairly common, and she always manages to somehow kind of overcome it and learn a lot through everything, and she really kind of grows and develops throughout the book.
And yet it's not overly didactic.
No, definitely not, because she is naive and humbling and everything about her. You know, she never wants to seem pompous, and especially with, you know, being the girl from Idaho, I think she tries to keep that like prevalent in her views while she's with all these kind of rich celebutante friends.
Keep her Midwesternness.
Morals. Yeah, exactly.
Now, you are from the small town of Santa Fe and went to the big city. To what extent do you identify with the character Gemma?
I definitely do. I mean, I pulled that, I would say, from definitely moving from Santa Fe to New York, which was a crazy shock. I mean, it just, there's so many more people. You just one tiny little fly and, you know, 8 million. But I also, a lot of my friends in college I'd spent some time in New York growing up, just like for spring break and things. So it wasn't that huge, but I had friends that had never been to New York. And it's just, there's a look in somebody's eye when they go there for the first time. It's just like this crazy twinkle. And it's sort of hard to describe, but it's really amazing. And there's just energy. It's just an instant rush. That's sort of, Santa Fe's a lot more laid back, you know?
Yeah, having been to New York recently, the energy in the streets is palpable, and it's very compelling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you get kind of an instant rush, especially if you go, you know, to Times Square or somewhere that's, you know, majorly touristy area. And it's just such a whoosh of energy, and there's just a buzz, and it's something that I don't think you can have that feeling anywhere else. So it's pretty incredible.
There's another kind of sexual harassment in the book that's a theme, and, you know, in a world full of sexual harassment, it's unfortunate there's also people who make it up in order to ruin somebody else's life.
Yeah, well, I think that's something that in any job, you know, there's so many lectures and discussions and seminars about sexual harassment, really making everybody so incredibly overly aware of it. And then there, unfortunately, are, in my book, there are some girls that use it to their advantage, and they're always trying to get the upper hand. They are the nemesis of the book, and they use it to their advantage, and ultimately doesn't really work out, so which is good. But it's
because of our stalwart heroine.
Yep, she becomes quite the little Nancy Drew and kind of figures everything out and really saves somebody's career, because that's obviously really crippling to your career if you're fired for a sexual harassment charge. So
when you say there's a million little seminars and everybody's overly aware of this, I mean, is it really too much? Do they exaggerate in a company like where you worked?
I mean, it's definitely something, especially if there is some sort of vague situation where there's, you know, possibly, oh, was that person sexually harassing somebody else? Then that's when the seminars really start to multiply, and you have, you know, we meet up in the conference room and we have a little discussion, and it sort of turns into a bigger deal than it is. It's like looking at everything through magnifying glass when you just make a mountain out of a molehill. But I think, I mean, it's obviously an incredibly important issue that everybody needs to be aware of. But there's being aware of it, and then there's, you know, having it thrust in your face, which I think can happen. I mean, it definitely, we didn't have, you know, an overabundance of these types of seminars and, you know, pamphlets and things. But I know, from having friends that have worked in various jobs in the city, I know that it definitely happens.
So there's also this phenomenon of the TV talk show in which ordinary people are put on stage in front of millions of others, but then their lives have to continue, and sometimes the show has consequences on their lives. That's another basic element of the plot.
Yeah, that was definitely directly taken from my experiences. I mean,
I wondered about that.
We did. I've done tons of shows, and a lot of them, you know, they really affect people's lives. A lot of them, we did shows, you know, people that had lost all their money in whatever circumstance, and I would track down colleges that would give a free college scholarship or, you know, help.
That was your
start
job.
Up a business. Yeah, I mean, my job specifically was to. Well, I had a lot of different things. I was a researcher, and I would call people. I'd read a news article and you know, call somebody up and say, oh, hey, you know, I just heard that, like, you know, won some fantastic prize. You won the lottery, or, you know, you've done some amazing thing for your hometown, and would you like to come on the show? And some people wanted to. Some people thought it was a really great experience, and some people thought it was more of a scam and just kind of hung up. But the main story in Back Talk, she meets a kind of a teen runaway prostitute and helps her get her life on track and helps sort out getting a scholarship to a school and really turning her life around, which is really one of our main goals at the show that I worked at, was really trying to help people, you know, whether it be getting somebody put behind bars for molestation or whatever they had done, or really just trying to turn somebody's life for the better and, you know, give people hope that they could do the same.
So getting somebody put behind bars, I mean, that's an interesting example of the relationship between the media and the criminal justice system.
Yeah, well, we had an especially, I don't know, it was easier for us, I think, because of the John Walsh angle, and he's the host of America's Most Wanted, which gave him the immediate advantage of already, you know, having a good rapport with law enforcement and everything. And a lot of the shows that we did were about criminals that had been, that, you know, that were missing, and you know, and so the victims would come on the show and they would talk about it, and we would post the pictures, and definitely a few times people watching the show would see the picture, spot the criminal, and they would get arrested. I mean, I know that definitely happened a handful of times, in addition to all the work that he's done with America's Most Wanted. But that was incredible. I mean, talk about, like, you know, we worked really hard. We worked 15-hour days, almost 6 days a week. And then at the end of it, when, you know, a little girl that's been kidnapped is rescued because of something that we did, I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's so worthwhile. It's really incredible.
We're talking to Alex Richards, and the book is called Back Talk. In the novel, there is something happens to the girl, the young runaway prostitute girl, and she is in trouble, you know, as a consequence of the whole thing of having been on the show. And one of the producers is really not that excited about helping.
Yeah, well, there's a certain mentality in that industry of, well, you know, once I've gotten the show done, I've gotten all the good ratings that I needed, it's really out of my hands now. There were a lot of situations where guests would call days or weeks later, asking for some follow-up. And some producers were less, forthcoming than others. Some people just really did sort of seem very jaded, and they said, well, it's not my problem anymore. I just, put it through to my voicemail. But, a lot of people didn't. And it's a fine line, and I think Gemma, being so young and kind of wide-eyed, and she just wants to save the world, like most of us do, at least at some point, she really tries to go above and beyond. And when somebody at the show sort of says, whatever, she really tries to take it into her own hands, which I think is very impressive. And there are definitely a lot of people like that. But then, there's just, you can get any number of situations, and kind of people try and pawn off their problems once they have their big moment on TV.
I have to ask you, how in the world did you survive six days a week of 15-hour days? That's insane.
It really was insane. I think I aged about 10 years while I was working there. We would get to work at 8, and then depending on what kind of stress we were under trying to get our shows together, you need, the best guest ever. They have to be good looking. They have to have all their teeth. They have to be good talkers. They can't just give one word answers. It's just, there's so many requirements. So
even ordinary people,
it's just, they have to be, it was embarrassing sometimes calling people and saying, so, when you smile, how many teeth can you see?
Oh no, you would have to ask them that?
We would sometimes have to ask people that because, if not, then we would be prepared, and we would have them sent to our dentist, our company dentist.
No.
And there was one instance actually in a show when we had some family on, and we got him a full set of fake teeth because he didn't have any teeth, and he got off the show. And these cost about $600 to make, and you can keep them forever. He got off the show, and he just spit them into the trash can.
Oh, my goodness.
Like lit a cigarette. So, yeah, there are some really crazy things that happen. But so we always were looking for these really incredible guests, and sometimes we would have to stay at work until 1 in the morning looking for these great guests, due to the time difference. It was always 3 hours earlier in California, so we could reach people a little bit later.
What kind of guests did you have? What was the format?
It was a 6-segment show, and we did shows about stay-at-home dads and moms that, go off and strike it rich, making their own business, and then more serious shows about, safe haven laws, which were always really hard shows to book because a lot of the most intriguing shows have to do with young girls, which is something that I sort of addressed in the book, is that it's hard. Rarely are there names listed in the newspaper when it's a story about, a 13, 14-year-old girl who's committed a crime or been the victim of a crime. So you really have to go above and beyond to track these people down. And then, shows about rapists and, there were some really heavy things because...
And you would have perpetrators on the air?
We often had them via satellite from jail. That was the only way to do it, unless there was a situation where the person had not been actually convicted of a crime, so we were able to have kind of two sides of a story. That's always your number one goal, is to get two sides of a story, because otherwise, you never know what kind of, if anybody's lying, and there's nobody else to kind of contradict or anything. So that was what made it really hard, and that's what kept our hours so long, was really looking for but two sides to everything, and always making sure, one of my producers said something about always making sure you have a pink elephant that can fly, and which is not always easy to find.
Well, and it's also, I would think a real challenge. You start with a concept like single moms who struck it rich, and then you have to go out and actually find these people. How do you do it? Where do you start?
Well, you start, local papers. They're always... in a small town, the local paper always makes it like a really huge story, and then it's just you kind of gather together about 15 of them, and then we would have a meeting with the executive producer and sort of show, before we booked anybody, we'd need a picture of them and to have like a little bit of a talk with them, and then you just look for the most above and beyond, this woman that went from being a stay-at-home mom to becoming a fashion designer, and she makes handbags to the stars, so that's a pretty good success story,
but she has to be good looking and have all her teeth. I mean, this is the thing that is so horrifying about our country is this media illusion that everybody is beautiful and that you do not qualify, you know, to be a citizen if you're not.
Right. Well, and that was hard because sometimes you talk to somebody and they would sound like a really great guest, but then you kind of, I would show it to my producers and we'd all look and be like, oh, that is really good, but you know, we still don't have an African American guest for this show, or it would be great if we could, you know, get some diversity. So that person that seemed pretty good would end up kind of not making the cut because we just needed something else. We need to kind of broaden the spectrum, and it was really hard. You know, we just worked so gruelingly to find these perfect guests, and then I a lot of times I would really like fall in love with a guest and really push for their story and try and get them on, and a lot of times it's like, sorry, they're just not going to make it. Like,
and then they go home disappointed. Or
exactly, yeah, you get their hopes up and they're like, I'm going to be on TV, and you know, and then that awful call where you have to let them know that they just didn't make it, and you know, sorry, but good
now,
luck with your life.
Do the guests who get on the air get paid?
They get a We called it like an honorarium, just, you know, a per diem that was for food. We would pay for their travel expenses. We tried to find local guests when we could in New York, but most times we flew people from around the country. So we would pay for their flight and hotel accommodations and then give them like, you know, $60 for food. So no, not any real, you know, but then there were the occasions where we had giveaways where I would call computer stores and try and get, you know, a computer donated, as long as, you know, we give them promotion in exchange, and all sorts of things that we would try. But that was a different circumstance. That wasn't really like payment. It was supposed to be the big payoff, like on the show, so that, you know, to kind of pull the heartstrings. And because whenever somebody's given, you know, a college scholarship, a homeless teenage girl is given a college scholarship on air, chances are she's going to cry, and then chances are the entire audience is going to cry, and chances are I in the back wings am going to cry. So,
well, I mean, it brings a question for me. To what extent is a show like the one you worked on and a show like the one in your book, Backtalk, you know, exploitation and manipulation on the one hand versus really doing some good?
Yeah, it's a tug of war, I think. I mean, we really wanted to do good. A lot of the shows were really geared toward trying to make a difference and trying to get laws changed. But then some, you know, we just wanted to do some fun, frivolous, you know, who cares, just, you know, shows. We did a show, we did a time warp show where we went back to 1984 and, you know, we got everybody to dress in 80s clothes, and we had a musical performance that was Denise Williams, who sang Let's Hear It for the Boy from Footloose, and then, but then also we had Geraldine Ferraro, who was the vice president nominee in 1984, and it just, we would try and mix and match as much, you know, serious and humor kind of aspects as we could, but it's hard because you want to keep your guests watching. You never know what kind of ratings you're going to get. You know, obviously we'd always shoot for, you know, amazing ratings, but you never know who's going to lose interest after the first segment. That's why you always put your absolute amazing, you know, guest in segment one. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't.
Now, what's the relationship between New York and California with a show like this? I mean, the TV industry is very, I guess, based in both places.
Yeah, it really is. It is both places. Well, and it's also Chicago. Oprah is based in Chicago.
That's right.
So I think I don't know if it really makes much of a difference. It's all, you know, these days especially, we all have the internet and, you know, you just fly a guest from anywhere and bring them into the studio at, you know, it's just part of the budget. I think our shows usually had a budget of about $10,000. So flights and, you know, transportation, all that stuff sort of took like a large chunk of it. And then getting props and just everything and music. But I think, I don't think there is really much of a difference between New York and California. If there is, I don't really know about it. I only worked at one show and I was there for 2 years and I learned a lot and I made a lot of connections. And people that sort of, when I was doing my research, I would call up and ask them for some advice or, you know, just to, like, bounce ideas off with people that are still working All my friends are still in different shows.
And what do you do now? You're a full-time writer?
Yeah, I basically am. I'm finishing my second novel right now, and really excited about that. I've been doing a lot. I got married last month, so I've been, actually that was incredibly time-consuming, but and I also make movies, sort of, but that's more of a pastime than an actual job, so.
One of the things that cracked me up in the book was the amount of drinking that these teenagers do, because we have people in the show on a fairly regular basis who are talking about, you know, from a bureaucratic level, doing something about underage drinking, and it seems like such a joke.
Well, it's funny because when I first wrote the book, the girls were older, they were about 19, and if they ever drank, it was sort of like one glass of wine, and they were like, ooh, I'm a little tipsy, and my agent was like, you gotta kind of bump it up a little bit. You need to think
for
more.
Reality's sake or for literature's sake?
Well, I think a combination of both, and, you know, when I think back on it, you know, high school was not as, you know, straight-laced as...
Teetotaling as
well. Yeah. So I think...
Even here in Santa Fe?
Even in Santa Fe. So it was... I think that it sort of is a lot more natural, and it's... You know, it might be a little horrifying, I think, to people, but it's pretty realistic.
Now, I was reading through the book, and the heroine makes a reference to potatoriot.com, which I've looked up to see if this is real or not, and that's, in fact, your website.
That's right. Yeah, it's... My agent and my editor actually were like, you should really put in a reference to Potato Riot, because we make zombie movies, very funny, our attempt is to be funny, they're not serious, zombie movies. And so at some point in the book, I thought I should just put something in, and so I just threw a little, you know, in hopes that somebody like you would just look it up and maybe watch one of our movies or just check out the website. So it's fun. I've drawn a lot of personal experiences and references. I don't really know Idaho very well, but that's where my best friend is from. And that's when I first started writing the character. I sort of wanted to give a little nod to my best friend. And that was sort of why I started there. And then it actually became a lot more prevalent as to why she was from there. It kind of helped explain what she was doing in New York. She met her friends when she was working at Sun Valley, which is the huge celebrity ski resort in Idaho. And that's how she ends up getting the job, is because her friends... mother is sort of a B-list actress and knew somebody on the show, on the Back Talk show, and sort of helps her get her foot in the door. Because internships are really, you know, hard. It's really hard to get a good internship. There's a lot of competition. So that sort of helped her. And so she feels even more, you know, dedicated, and I really have to prove myself because this was sort of done for me as a favor. So she thinks she has sort of all this extra pressure to sort of make good.
Now, when you're starting to write a novel like this, I mean, the content you have in the novel, clearly, I mean, it's things that you know, things you've seen, but in terms of the form of the novel, who were some of your influences? What other literature did you read and draw from?
Well, I've always loved Judy Blume. I mean, that's sort of, she's the pinnacle of YA teen literature. And then there's a lot of more current stuff, like Gossip Girl is huge. I mean, it's beyond huge. It's being made into a TV show. And that sort of thing. There's so many, you know, the A-list, a lot of books that are, they're very similar, but...
So it's not like you were reading Tolstoy?
Well, no, I wasn't. But I mean, I guess I pulled from a lot of different things. I don't know. I've read so many books that I like that I wouldn't really say that there was one genre. I love like current fiction. I like classics. I love Jane Austen, and that sort of helps, you know, with a lot of romance aspects of it.
Right.
Yeah, I would say.
Now, we've got just a moment left, and we're going to go to Robert Mirabal in a couple of minutes, but would you like to read a page or two from the book?
Okay, yeah. Let's see.
We're talking to Alex Richards. The book is called Back Talk. She'll be at Garcia Street Books today at 5 o'clock.
Okay, this is the third chapter, just when she's come back home from her first day of work. Gemma stood on the sidewalk outside Dana's apartment. This was Dana's apartment, right? Hard to tell, what with all the people sitting on the stoop smoking cigarettes and drinking 40s. Gemma wasn't sure about private property laws in New York, but this had to be illegal. She got her keys out of her bag and stepped gingerly over a slutty drunk girl. Excuse me, she muttered. She unlocked the outer door, stopping dead in her tracks in the foyer. The inner door that was usually deadbolted shut was wide open, and an uber-cool teens packed the hallway in the front of her. Gemma hugged her bag to her chest, awkwardly squeezing past rich girls in trendy cocktail dresses, discussing Givenchy lip gloss and the new It jeans. And it wasn't just her imagination. Everyone was staring at her. As far as house parties go, it was pretty tame. No table dancing, no brawls, no cops. Yet. Just 40 people grinding to Kanye West and Kelly Clarkson, pouring vodka into their Diet Cokes and being slightly X-rated on the Cox's matching suede sofas. If you played I Spy, you might even spot a starlet or the next Zach Posen, but Gemma was too busy trying to fight her way through the crowds to notice.
Alex Richards, the book is called Back Talk, and she will be at Garcia Street Books today at 5 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with musician Robert Mirabal. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. So I'm in Whole Foods produce department squeezing a kumquat when I heard a woman say, "Did you hear about KSFR? They're moving up." And it's true. We're moving up the FM dial to 101.1. This will give us a better sound and bigger coverage. And right now, you can hear us simultaneously on both 90.7 and 101.1. This is a big deal, and we've received a number of celebrity congratulations, including this one.
This is Robin Williams, and I just want to say congratulations and, simultaneously speaking, good morning, Santa Fe!
Okay, let's get to the real point. Now that we are being heard from Albuquerque to Taos, I thought it was only right to bring my lawyer in to renegotiate my contract. Scooter, thanks for coming in.
Hey, it's better than being in jail.
Yeah. So, what do you think the chances are of me getting a sweeter deal here at KSFR?
Well, Ron, let me just ask, how much are you being paid now?
Nothing.
Well, I think we can double that.
So I'll be getting double nothing?
If we play our cards right.
But I want to see some cash.
Ron, with their stronger signal, you'll become a household name in places like Lone Butte. That's worth quite a bit. I'm afraid they may ask you to pay them for being on KSFR.
Okay, then, how about some perks? A week in Paris, a cruise to Alaska. All right, a piece of carrot cake.
The carrot cake may be doable. I'll talk to management, but don't get your hopes up.
Right. And I'll talk to you next week, simultaneously, if you have a minute.
Okay, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the site santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Don't forget, KSFR is moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. For the next few months, we are simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FMs. It's all Santa Fe Public Radio, but our eventual only frequency will be 101.1, where we will be able to be heard throughout northern New Mexico from probably about Taos to Albuquerque. So it's a wonderful move for KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. And have a wonderful day, and we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.